Bat Segundo, the host of this program, is still nowhere to be found. Frightened by this podcast's unexpected involvement with the Litblog Co-op, Mr. Segundo, disapproving of this show's Bolshevik ties, disappeared with Jorge into the Mojave Desert with several horses, a bottle of tequila, a magazine of crossword puzzles, a good deal of paper products purchased at random, and a secondhand machete to see if he might find himself. Perhaps he's simply pulling a diva act, but he has asked me to assure all listeners that he has not seen the movie Brokeback Mountain, and that he is quite confident about who he is. He has the 12-step program certificate to prove it. I've seen it. It's hanging on his wall. I should also note that Jorge is accompanying Mr. Segundo only because, well, he may not be worth it, but we are paying him far more money than we should. He is not a valet. He is a source of encouragement. And in fact, he can be employed by you. But Mr. Segundo's absence is not important, for this week we have one of the most exciting novelists to come out of the United Kingdom, who ventured at a far greater distance across the Atlantic to speak with our young roving correspondent, recently nominated for the Orange Prize. Named by Grana as one of 20 novelists to watch, Sarah Waters spoke with our young roving correspondent and was particularly gracious, even as our young roving correspondent tried to squeeze 45 minutes of questions into 25 minutes. Perhaps Mr. Segundo didn't care for our young roving correspondent's caffeinated staccato or the way he talked so fast, but perhaps he's simply being a boorish and irresponsible man. Well, the show must go on, damn it! Without further ado, here is Sarah Waters! Okay, I am here with Sarah Waters, author of not only Fingersmith, but now The Night Watch, who is luckily here in America. How are you doing, Sarah?
I'm doing all right, thanks.
How are you holding up with all the crazy tours?
Okay. This is my fourth city now, so I'm feeling a little bit tired from the travelling, but, you know, the meeting people and doing events side of things is great. I like that.
Okay. Well, first off, I want to talk about this issue of you describing your previous books as romps.
Yes.
And get this whole romp question out of the way.
Yeah.
The phrase you used is lesbo-Victorian romps. You actually said in a 2002 interview, why did I allow the phrase lesbo-Victorian romp to cross my lips? First off, A, what's wrong with a romp? B, to what extent is The Night Watch possibly rompish?
Yeah.
Even though I know it is a transition book and it is a certainly more mature book. And outside of placing this book in an entirely different setting, what rules did you, as a novelist, sort of set up to ensure that this book would be totally different from your other ones? So I'm sorry to bombard you with a baggy monster of a question, but
okay.
I have a tendency to do that.
Yeah, so. Sure. Well, the romp thing, I mean, I think I've probably used that phrase. In fact, I know I used that phrase about Tipping the Velvet, which,
yeah.
You know, it suits very well. Tipping the Velvet is a romp in lots of different ways. You know, it's a very upbeat novel. It's got a real relish for kind of sex and all mm-hmm. sorts of appetites, really. But, you know, Affinity, the next book, is a much grimmer, darker book, and Fingersmith is more upbeat. And I think, if anything, I used the phrase to... I've never wanted to kind of take myself too seriously, you know,
yeah.
And this was a way of doing that. I mean, of not doing that.
Yeah.
So, The Night Watch. I don't know, The Night Watch, I don't think you could really call The Night Watch a bit of a romp. It's definitely... One of the things I enjoyed doing with, say, Fingersmith was reveling in all that kind of Victorian melodrama.
Mm-hmm.
And with The Night Watch, I realised pretty quickly that I couldn't, you know, keep up all the sort of extravagance and the lushness of Victorian prose,
mm-hmm.
Which I'd so much enjoyed sort of using in the other books. That had to go, really. So The Night Watch is... You know, I tried to make it much more in the spirit of 40s fiction, British 40s fiction, which is much quieter, much more pared down, prose
yeah.
style, much drier somehow. And of course, the novel's written in the third person. You know, that seemed to suit the period, but it does have this rather, instead of it being a kind of emotional Victorian confessional novel, you know, it's rather sort of at arm's length kind of thing. And so I think all those things work against it being a romp, but it certainly has its... You know, it has its emotional moments, you know. And
it also has this very sort of astute kind of observations of, that could possibly be called gossipy, but at the same time are not so. I think calling it a romp is sort of, you know, I don't know if it's entirely fair because you're dealing with sort of character studies as opposed
uh-huh.
to, you know, a romp, which sort of implies that there is no character in any of your books, and that's not the case at all. And I guess I just wanted to sort of, I guess, dwell upon this uh-huh. sort of, this romp sort of thing.
So you think there are elements of rompishness?
Well,
to the new book?
What is a romp? Is a romp a frolicky, playful sort of thing? If so, well, you know, yes, but at the same time, it's literary. It has character study. You have very, you know, meticulous sort of prose from the Victorian novels and all that, and also in this, which we'll get into this in just a bit. But I'm not sure if it's entirely fair to call your books romps, because they are, at least from my standpoint, they are entertaining, certainly, but they're also very astute sort of character studies in how these people sort of interact and all that, interconnect and all that. So.
Sure, okay.
Okay. Anyway, enough about romps. This book, the prose in this is very interesting because it reminded me very much of Graham Greene with all the colons, and you also were very, very obsessed with the sort of light.
Light, really?
Yeah. I mean, like, for example, the light that illuminates where the entire fabric is described and illuminating to, like, in every single detail of...
In
the second section.
Bomb.
Yes,
yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
And that was very, very Greenish. But at the same time, there were moments in the book that you kind of went away from that. So I guess I was wondering how much was Graham Greene an influence?
Well, I'm not sure how much of it was conscious, really. You know, I think it was, I read continuously, you know, 40s novels as I was writing the book, as well as other 40s texts, you know, diaries and things. And certainly, I mean, Greene has written some of the fabulous wartime novels, Ends of the Affair, Ministry of Fear. And I was very, very taken with those novels and, you know, kind of hoped, I suppose, that something Greenish would seep into the book. But for me, you know, he was just one novelist amongst many. Elizabeth Bowen, Elizabeth Taylor, Neville Shute's Requiem for a Wren. That's an extraordinary novel about the Second World War. So it was funny for me, actually, to sort of... It was almost like I had to sit back and watch as my prose style changed, you know. And just sort of let it happen. And I was a bit resistant to it at first. But in the end, you know, it suited the period. It just kind of worked, you know, it sort of suited the period. So I just had to let it happen.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you kind of worry, perhaps, that maybe this sort of interferes with your own sort of personal voice as a writer, that when you do a lot of this research and you soak up and you sort of almost imprint your brain with a particular tone or a particular sort of concept, this might interfere with your own sort of identity?
Yeah, I mean, what is an author's own voice, really? It was kind of interesting to me to make this move because one of the reasons I had wanted to make the move was precisely to see what happened to my writing, you know, if I was taking on a different period. And, you know, there has been an extent to which I've been ventriloquizing, you know, other voices or another period in the books. And it was unclear to me as I was writing this, you know, how much of it, how the Night Watch would sit, for example, alongside the other three novels, you know, how much there would be something that was consistently mine across them all. And, you know, actually, so far, readers do seem to have found kind of continuities across the books, which I wasn't really aware of, you know. But I think maybe those things arise much more from... theme and imagery. I mean, certainly light and dark are things that have come up for me, preoccupations of mine in other novels, you know. I mean, Millbank, the world of Millbank and Affinity, the kind of dark, gloomy worlds. And that, you know, with The Night Watch, thinking about it now, it was the blacked out landscapes, you know, that drew me for large parts of the book. And of course, you know, the sort of single points of brightness, which in turn, you know, pan out sort of thematically, because what the novel, you know, it's a melancholy novel, but it is the melancholy, which is all about the sort of failure of intimacy or loss or disappointment or whatever, you know, I hope is relieved by these sort of points of brightness around genuine kind of contact between people, like with the Viv and the Ring and, you know, sort of moments like that. So the light and the dark really makes sense for me.
Well, this also struck me as there were a lot more specific sort of... metaphors and the imagery in this book. Like, for example, thighs played a very...
Thighs.
Really? There were a lot of thighs in this book. I was actually, you know, everything from thighs being lusted for to thighs being, you know, touched to even Fraser and Pierce sitting on the bank of the Thames, like, you know, thigh to thigh.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I just was wondering... What,
that's
what's,
something what, I wasn't aware of.
Yeah, what's up with the thighs
what's
here?
What's up with the thighs?
Yeah.
It's a nice word.
It is.
It's a nice word, and it's a nice part of the... It's an interesting part of the human body, because obviously it's kind of... Of course, Helen cuts her thigh, and there's that moment when she cuts her thigh and she's looking at it, and it seems like this formless piece of flesh that could be any part of the human body.
Yeah.
You know, and it does have that kind of shapeless anonymity about it, and yet at the same time it is an incredibly intimate part of the human body. you know, so maybe it was that, maybe it was something about that tension that I liked.
I just thought it was like possibly mythological to some degree, like, you know, it was again going to the theme of this book, which is relationships and people kind of, you know, having problems and difficulties on those. The thigh kind of represented this way to kind of show a potential connection that was sometimes there and sometimes not. But I mean, every time everyone sat together, it was like thigh to thigh. It was a very, very interesting emphasis, I think.
I shall have to look out for that when I go back to the book.
Well, and also, of course, you know, timepieces and watches are very...
Yes.
Very
motif. Yeah, I ended up having, you know, taking some of those out because there were really too many references. My editor said there's too many references to clocks and watches here. So I think I took some out, but certainly I was interested in, you know, time sort of in different ways really in the novel. You know, in the first part my sense was that time had sort of stopped, time had got stuck, you know, there's Kay living with sort of stopped watches and clocks, and then in the second part kind of time was running out, you know, for the characters in all sorts of ways. They were hurtling towards these things.
Let's talk about the structure of the book, which is three parts going backwards, which is a definite interesting departure from you. At the same time, I know that as you're writing this, you kind of have to keep your cards kind of close to your chest because you can't reveal certain things that are revealed later. When reading this, I almost felt like I had to kind of momentarily rewire my brain, but I was kind of fascinated with these characters. What steps did you take to sort of... What rules did you set in terms of what you would reveal and what you wouldn't?
Again, it's hard to say because it's one of those things that you have to kind of feel your way through. You know, it has to become a kind of intuitive thing that... It was a tricky device to make work. I mean, I like technical challenges. So actually, in that sense, it was, you know, I liked working out what bit of information needed to be revealed when, you know, to keep the reader interested. But my anxiety around it was precisely about, will the reader stay interested? You know, part one is a very static part. The character, you know, the characters literally aren't going anywhere. But nevertheless, I had to ask my readers to kind of stay with me for however many pages, 100 pages or whatever. There are a lot of, you know, it was quite a lot to take on, taking on characters who were tired, who were stuck, who were didn't want to talk very much, and hope that the reader would stay with them. And then, for me, you know, the payoff was part two, which was suddenly dramatic and had movement and had pace, you know, and was kind of providing those more traditional sort of... readerly pleasures, I suppose. And again, you know, the thing about readerly pleasure, I know that personally as a reader, you know, I like the traditional kind of beginning, middle, end, closure, resolution. And this novel, you know, gives a very different sort of resolution. And I couldn't anticipate how it would read to a reader, really. So again, it's been interesting getting feedback. Lots of people say that when they finish it, they want to go back and reread part one.
Oh, absolutely. And I wish I had read it the second time before talking with you, but because I definitely felt the same impulse. At the same time, though, you know, keeping the plot sort of, you know, keeping the details of what happened and what led these characters up to who they were, did this kind of get in the way of character development for you in terms of, like, we don't quite know exactly the way they tick, but we're hoping to find out. And I guess it's sort of like, I know that in the Washington Post, Tracy Chevalier actually wrote a review, and she said that, you know, she kind of missed the romp, so to speak, or the exuberance, rather, the kind of extravagance that we were kind of mentioning earlier. But also that sort of, I guess, did you declare a war on that, or did you really consciously try to go for something different here?
I didn't know, you know, what was going to happen, really. And what, I think at first... when I decided to move period, I kind of thought I could take some of that Victorian exuberance with me. But what I hadn't anticipated was how much the feel of the period would not allow me to do that, actually, and would produce this much quieter, much gloomier book, which, you know, I ultimately got to really love. But it was a question of finding different things to relish, if you know what I mean. And certainly there were some things that I brought from the other books, you know, a kind of interest in the fabric, you know, the sort of fabric surrounding the physical landscape, the kind of slightly haunting landscape of London at war, you know. It was just a question of finding different ways in to that, I don't know.
Well, like also, for example, the meals in this book, the sort of romantic idylls to, like, you know, the picnics and the... actually, you paid very, very much, very close attention to the food and how it was wrapped. And I found that to be a remarkable departure from your other books. It was interesting, but it also felt timely to that sort of period, particularly when we're dealing with like a period of rationing.
Yeah. I mean, people in the 40s were absolutely obsessed with food. You know, it's all they thought about. It's all they talked about. But it was different. It was funny, you know, because I suppose I wanted to write about food and I wanted to write about clothes, as I'd done to a certain extent in the other novels.
Yeah.
But those very things were you know, clothes were falling apart, you know, for people in the 40s. And food, as you say, was very scarce. So the kind of emphasis had to become slightly different, you know, necessarily became kind of difficult. And small sort of details like the pyjamas, you know, that satin pyjamas suddenly looms much larger than details like that would have done in the other novels, in when they were embedded in a, you know, across a sort of material landscape, all of which was quite sort of lush or interesting. Mm-hmm. This was a very sort of denuded landscape.
Well, Helen in this book is quite a piece of work, I must say.
Yeah.
The interesting thing about her character, though, that I found a decision from you, I think, was that I didn't quite entirely understand how the other women were sort of attracted to her, because she was clearly trying to drag them down. And, you know, granted, even accounting sort of for the folly of youth, I was wondering why you sort of refrained from that particular choice of explaining why these characters were attracted to her, because...
It's probably just, I think it is something that I wish I'd been able to do more. Mm-hmm. And it was partly a problem around the fact that, you know, given that this is an ensemble novel, and you know, in each chapter, you know, there's a scene from each of the characters' kind of lives, really. And I ended up realizing I actually didn't have much space to kind of, you know, space was at a real premium for talking about the characters and their relationships. And that is one of the things that suffered, I know. I don't know. I kind of let that go, really.
I mean, it's an interesting mystery. It's like, I'm almost tempted, when I do read this book a second time, to sort of find out if there are any kind of like small clues as to what is it about Helen besides, I mean, you know, I know people who are in that kind of relationship, you know, and it's sort of like, you know, you kind of stand aside and you watch them sort of in this insufferable sort of situation.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, it's common, isn't it?
That
I mean, relationships are always a mystery. You know, I have very dear friends who are going out with people and I'm, you know, to me it's inexplicable, you know, what the attraction is. So that's not strange or uncommon, but I would have liked to have been able to give a bit more, you know, about what. I mean, I think with you know, Kay's interest in Helen was about this kind of, you know, Kay was a rescuer and you were somebody who, you know, she had literally rescued, and then kind of this, I don't know, this blonde kind of pale, you know, she wanted to be the husband to her and all that. I think the Julia thing was I'd like to have done a bit more on, but Julia's attraction to Helen, really.
But the thing that actually, though, is interesting about Helen is that you raise a very interesting point.
Yeah.
Is it the wartime environment that made her sort of like this, or is it her own sort of makeup, irrespective of where she is, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, maybe there's like an ambiguity there, perhaps. I don't know.
Yeah.
Was this something you were thinking about when writing this novel, or...?
No, not when you say the wartime environment.
You know, nature versus nurture.
But do you mean the war? Do you mean the 40s? Or?
Yeah. I mean, and also the post-war environment too at the beginning.
I mean, there was definitely something about, you know, I was kind of definitely interested in lesbian relationships and the particular pressures, you know, on gay relationships. And I think, you know, lesbian and gay relationships have been a bit more paranoid, you know, than other relationships. They don't have things in society kind of supporting them and reinforcing them. I've heard, you know, or seen on film, older lesbians talking about, you know, when they were younger, it being so hard to find a partner, that once you've got one, you kind of hung on to them, you know, for far longer than was really sensible.
Yeah.
And, you know, certainly lesbians have been prone to self-harm and alcoholism and things like that, you know, and I think, so that was kind of in my head, certainly with Helen and Julia's relationship, that there were particular pressures on it making it the way it was.
Do you have any sort of problems being pigeonholed as a lesbian writer? You know, doesn't this get in the way of perhaps Joe Sixpack, particularly in this country, too?
Yeah.
Sort of understanding that relationships have the same sort of problems no matter what their orientation, no matter what their structure.
Well, I mean, the lesbian label is not one I'd ever want to shun, know, kind of, because that seems to me to be something kind of unpleasant about that. And certainly, you know, I'm a lesbian writer, and there is a clear lesbian agenda in all my books so far. And I've, you know, I have a strong lesbian readership, and I'm, you know, I feel very grateful for that. And so I've never, it's never really bothered me. And I've, to be honest, I've not experienced any obvious problems from having the lesbian label attached to me. I mean, it may be a bit different here. In the UK, I think mainly because of the books getting on TV. You know, I have crossed over and got a much wider audience. And I've become known as, you know, just a kind of mainstream writer, really, as well as having this lesbian fan base. So, I don't know, it's not something I've ever really sought to control, if you know what I mean.
Well, sort of like even being a mystery writer or a science fiction writer. It's the same sort of thing. It's like, you know, it's like, well, this is a science fiction book. I'm not going to pick it up. You know, I mean, it's really this genre ghettoization, I mean, I suppose. What was I going to say? Oh, yeah, you mentioned at this book fair in Australia that you wanted to respect the time of the 1940s, that you wanted to preserve a certain sort of decorum. At least this is what I read. Yeah. I was wondering if you could talk about this or why there was, you know, because I think you had said that because there are still people living from that time, you didn't want to sort of upset them. I was wondering if you could sort of talk about
that. Well, it wasn't quite as like that. It was just, it was more, you know, I was talking about the difference about writing about the 40s compared to writing about the 19th century when, you know, I knew nobody was ever going to come along and say it wasn't like that. So, you know, it was a great resource when I was writing The Night Watch to have people to ask. You know, my parents were kids during the war, so I could talk to them about stuff. It was great. But the downside of it was, you know, that I was slightly more anxious to get things right because I knew people would notice. But also, I also felt somehow that because the period is still within the living memory, that I did, I don't know, I just had this sense that I had to kind of respect it. Mm-hmm. Maybe it was a sense that I didn't want to seem like this upstart, you know. I mean, I clearly didn't live in the 40s, and I found myself at events kind of blithely talking about what the 40s were like. You know, while there are people in my audience who were there, you know, and know for themselves. So it's just, I just felt I needed to be a bit more, a bit more respectful about that, really. Cool. And maybe there is something that happens to a period once it slips out of living memory. Mm-hmm. Maybe it becomes a bit more available for kind of playing around with or something.
Well, you could invent the details without anyone sort of, you know, checking up on you, I guess.
Yeah.
But at the same time, though, you know, to what extent should literature be confrontational?
Oh, yeah.
Or should it to break boundaries? I mean, I mean, you know, there's a case to be made for, like, you know, uniting people, like, and I know you've done, definitely you've done your share to sort of allow gay relationships to sort of be accessible to mainstream audiences. Mm. But at the same time, is there a point in your writing that, you know, you have to sort of, like, you know, punch through the wall? Or,
oh, right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, I mean, I didn't mean anything like that when I used the word respect. I didn't mean that I would not go somewhere or not write something, you know, because I felt I couldn't. I had to be careful. It wasn't anything like that. It was just a kind of an awareness that this was real, you know, this was, you know, not that long ago, and it's, you know, it kind of, just the sense that it somehow the period slightly belonged to the people who could still remember it, you know. And that was an extra issue for me that I hadn't had to deal with before.
Now, how did you conduct the research for this? Because the research, essentially, you were very, very more explicit with your sources in this book than you were in, like, your other books. And I guess, and we were talking earlier about, like, how some of the tone kind of carried over into the book. Did you just do it all in one go, or did you sort of, like, do it as you were writing? Or?
Mainly as I was writing. I think I think, as with the other books, I started off with maybe 3 or 4 months solid research to just give me, you know, enough knowledge about the 40s to be able to feel confident about writing about it, or to be able to make imaginative kind of leaps.
Yeah.
So, you know, at that point, I made decisions like about having somebody drive an ambulance, you know, or somebody working for the Ministry of Food. And of course, once I'd made those decisions, then I could go back and do research more, but in a more focused kind of way. So research for me is always, always ongoing. I mean, I do it right to the last minute, you know, I'm kind of reading. And it was mainly reading and diaries from the period, novels obviously, books about the war, books about the 40s, but also looking at, like I went to local archives in London and looked at civil defence records and air raid pamphlets and, you know, what to do after a raid, that kind of thing. So that just carried on the whole time.
Well, I wanted to ask you about the page-turner aspect.
Yeah.
And the plotting.
Yeah.
And I meant to ask you this. In this, it's just as tightly plotted as your other books, even though the structure is different. And what's, I was wondering, what steps do you sort of take to ensure? I mean, there seems to be a very major concern on your part to sort of keep the reader's interest, as we were talking to earlier.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, that's partly because, as a reader myself, as a long-term passionate reader, I have a sense of what I like from a book, you know, and it is to feel engaged. It is to feel teased, I suppose, to a certain extent, or kind of feeling like I'm being taken somewhere for a reason, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so I've always tried to do that in my own books. This was a very, writing Night Watch was a very different experience to the other books because, I mean, they were increasingly plot-driven, and which meant I had to have the plots worked out in advance, you know, before almost I wrote a word. But with this novel, because it's more character-based, all I really had at the start were the characters and the backwards movement.
Huh.
And the broadest kind of sense of what had happened to the characters. So I really had to figure out the smaller details of the plot as I was writing it, which made it a very labour-intensive process.
Did you find this liberating to some degree?
No, I found it really unsettling. And
not having an outline.
Yeah, I didn't like it at all. I just didn't like it. It was just frustrating. And because I would write a scene, and I tend to write quite precise in a fairly polished way, you know,
yeah,
as I'm going along. And so I would spend a lot of time on a scene only to decide either that I should abandon it completely or, you know, I needed to rewrite it. I did that endlessly with this book. And it made it satisfying in the end, precisely because it had been so difficult. But it wasn't a process that I enjoyed at all.
Anyway, I know you have to get going.
Yes, I
so,
do.
So, pleasure chatting with you.
Yeah, you too.
30 old river, must you keep rolling, flowing into the night? People so busy, make me feel dizzy, taxi light shines.